Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for September 21st, 2025, the cover story. It isn't just the U.S., the whole world has soured on climate politics. How do we think about the climate future now that the era marked by the Paris Agreement has so utterly disappeared? And following this article, the big weight of small islands. A group of law students in the South Pacific watched as climate change ravaged their nations, so they took their grievances to the world's highest court. But first, it isn't just the U.S., the whole world has soured on climate change. This article was written by David Wallace Wells. 10 years ago this fall, scientists and diplomats from 195 countries gathered in Le Bourget, just north of Paris, and hammered out a plan to save the world. They called it, blandly, the Paris Agreement, but it was obviously a climate politics landmark, a nearly universal global pledge to stave off catastrophic temperature rise and secure a more livable future for all. Barack Obama, applauding the agreement as president, declared that Paris represented the best chance we have to save the one planet we've got. Paris wasn't just a brief flare of climate optimism. To many, it looked like the promise of a whole new era, not just for the climate, but also for our shared political future on this earth. Back then, the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon liked to talk about how sustainability would be for this century what human rights was for the previous one, the basis for a new moral and political order. His successor, Antonio Guterres, turned out to be an even more emphatic climate advocate, treating the Paris Agreement as though its significance approached, if not exceeded, that of the UN Charter itself. By design, the treaty wasn't a one-shot solution, just a first step. Other steps, it was broadly assumed, would follow, toward faster climate action, yes, but also toward greater global cooperation, mutual obligation, and solidarity. High off the success of its Millennium Development Goals, the UN had just released its far more ambitious Sustainable Development Goals, which brought the rich nations of the world into its lasso of responsibility. Diplomats talked optimistically about an emergent partnership they called the G2, with the United States and China cooperating on the world's biggest challenges as they had in Paris. A decade later, we are living in a very different world. At last year's UN Climate Change Conference, COP29, the president of the host country, Azerbaijan's Ilham Aliyev, praised oil and gas as gifts from God, and though the annual conference since Paris were often high-profile, star-studded affairs, this time there were few world leaders to be found. Joseph R. Biden, then still president, didn't show. Neither did Vice President Kamala Harris or President Xi Jinping of China, or President Ursula von der Leyen of the European Commission, nor did President Emmanuel Macron of France, often seen as the literal face of Western liberalism, or President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of Brazil, often seen as the face of an emergent movement of solidarity across the poor and middle-income world. In the run-up to the conference, an official UN report declared that no climate progress at all had been made over the previous year, and several of the most prominent architects of the whole diplomatic process that led to Paris published an open letter declaring the agreement's architecture out of date and in need of major reform. This year's conference, which takes place in Brazil this November, is meant to be more significant. COP30 marks 10 years since Paris, and all 195 parties to the 2015 agreement are supposed to arrive with updated decarbonization plans called nationally determined contributions, or NDCs. But when one formal deadline passed this past February, only 15 countries, just 8%, had completed the assignment. Months later, more plans have trickled in, but arguably only one is actually compatible with the goals of the Paris Agreement. The climate scientist Piers Forster recently calculated, and more than half of them represent backsliding. The most conspicuous retreat, of course, has been the United States under President Trump, who first announced his intention to withdraw from Paris way back in 2017 with a ceremony in the Rose Garden. Trump has celebrated his return to office by utterly dismantling his predecessor's signature climate bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, and vowing to stop all approvals for new renewable projects, not to mention paving over the same garden. But this is not just a story about Trump. When Paris was forged, the United States was a trivial exporter of natural gas, and it was still illegal to ship American oil abroad. Even before Trump's second inauguration, the country had become the world's largest producer and exporter of refined oil and liquid natural gas. And neither is it a story particular to America. The retreat from climate politics has been widespread, even in the midst of a global green energy boom. From 2019 to 2021, governments around the world added more than 300 climate adaptation and mitigation policies each year, according to the energy analyst Nat Boulard. In 2023, the number dropped under 200. In 2024, it was only 50 or so. In many places, like in South America and in Europe, existing laws have already been weakened or under pressure from shifting political coalitions, now pushing to undermine them. To our north, the former central banker Mark Carney, whose 2015 warnings about the financial risks from climate change helped set the stage for Paris by alarming the world's banking elite, became Prime Minister of Canada in March, and his very first act in office struck down the country's carbon tax before storming to a landslide victory in the April election. To our south, President Claudia Sheinbaum of Mexico, a former climate scientist, has invoked the principle of energy sovereignty and boasted of booming oil and gas production in her country and enjoys one of the highest approval ratings of any elected leader anywhere in the world. Almost everywhere you look, the spike of climate alarm that followed Paris has given way to something its supporters might describe as climate moderation, but which critics would call complacency or indifference. You can't walk more than 2 feet at any global conference today without pragmatism and realism being thrown around as the order of the day, says Jason Bordoff, a former Obama energy advisor who now runs Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. But it's not clear to me that anyone knows what those words mean, other than this whole climate thing is just too hard. The world hasn't actually abandoned green energy, with global renewable rollout still accelerating and investment doubling over the last 5 years. But climate politics is in undeniable withdrawal and far from ushering in a new era of cooperative global solidarity. Paris has given way to something much more old-fashioned, an atavistic age of competition, renewed rivalry, and the increasingly naked logic of national self-interest on energy and warming, as with everything else. In the wake of America's presidential election, Alex Trembath of the Breakthrough Institute declared that the era of the climate hawk is over, perhaps, at least for now, the age of climate statesmen, too. It was in the heady aftermath of Paris that I first began writing about warming. In retrospect, it was a strange time to come of age, climate-wise. By any simple measure, the treaty looked like a breakthrough. In a representative tribute, The Guardian called it the world's greatest diplomatic success. But frustrated advocates were still filled with rage, sure that not enough was being done, and armed with the scientific reports to prove it. Remarkably, the world's leadership class mostly embraced the critique, inviting activists on stage at Davos and the UN General Assembly in performances of collective self-laceration designed, it seemed, to inspire yet more climate concern. What is perversely striking today is that those years do not look now like a low point for political commitment to climate action, but the opposite, at least when it comes to rhetoric, which is, of course, free. At the time, trying to raise concern about warming, I found myself again and again in conversation with world leaders of one kind or another, presidents and prime ministers, treasury secretaries and environmental ministers and climate diplomats, among others. Most were a bit less alarmed than I was and a bit more mindful of the obstacles to a rapid transition. But in those conversations and in public speeches and commentary, their concern was nevertheless palpable. In fact, they were often proud to showcase it as a totem of good faith and to invoke the ambitious Paris goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees, which many scientists had already concluded was a lost cause, as a necessary objective. It helped the climate activism in the aftermath of Paris, Fridays for Future and the climate strikers, Extinction Rebellion and Sunrise, look like a generational uprising, made more intense, of course, by the new powers of social media. Even those in power who weren't moved felt they had to respond, and high-profile scientific reports gave them extremely short timelines on which to do so. In describing their own awakenings, many leaders would also invoke private conversations they'd had on the subject with their children and grandchildren, who invariably faulted them for not moving faster, as relatives of corporate leaders did too. In a sense, the crisis seemed to offer a kind of redemptive opportunity to the whole technocratic liberal elite, whose social status and moral claim on leadership had somewhat crumbled since the financial crisis. The United States hadn't yet been rocked by the election of Donald Trump, nor Britain by Brexit, or the rest of the rich world by the wave of populist backlash that Brexit foreshadowed. But with the global war on terror long since dissipated into tragic farce and a new Cold War not yet well crystallized in the public imagination, the American-led global order seemed to be missing some sense of purpose, too. Here came the existential project of climate action to fill that semi-spiritual void, at least for some of those who felt it. The material context mattered too. Borrowing money had been cheap, indeed close to free, for almost a decade since the 2008 housing crash, and though Western countries generally embraced austerity and its immediate aftermath, many were beginning to think that might have been an economically damaging mistake. Looking around for places to invest, a green transition seemed like one obvious choice, which is why anyone trying to blue sky a brighter economic future for Europe invariably proposed huge increases in clean energy investment, and why American progressives conceived their ideal form of climate action at the scale and scope of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. The rapidly declining cost of green energy meant it all penciled out a bit better to boot. There were also moralistic or quasi-moralistic elements. In the years following Paris came more and more talk of climate justice, the ways that rich countries were choking the futures of the poor with carbon and temperature rise. This was just one of many similar reckonings with systemic social inequities in those years, and a green transition may have looked to world leaders like a more appealing and forward-focused way of expiating white guilt than, say, portioning out reparations for centuries of slavery or colonialism. Indeed, politicians and their appointees routinely dismiss calls to even discuss climate reparations, preferring to promise trillions of dollars in profit-seeking energy investment in the global South. Reader, they did not come. Outside the corridors of influence, rapid warming looked to some like comeuppance for cultural decadence and consumerist excess, with climate attaining sometimes apocalyptic features of a theological morality play. those frustrated that so few financiers had been legally held to account for the financial crisis could regard fossil fuel companies as a new set of villains, even if most policymakers were more inclined to make a positive-sum case for climate action than rail against the energy companies that still provided the vast bulk of the world's power. And as some climate protesters called for fundamental political transformations in the name of fighting warming, world leaders seemed inclined to blunt that drive by directing it toward a more focused purpose, rapid decarbonization within the guardrails of an existing order. You could see all this on display in 2021 in Glasgow at the first climate conference held in the aftermath of the COVID-19 emergency. There, world leaders paraded past one another, ecstatically unmasked, to reaffirm in the most dramatic terms that even as the world was stumbling back onto its feet out of the pandemic shadows, climate change was still the paramount crisis of the day. In fact, at least briefly, the experience of the pandemic seemed to give the urgency of climate action an additional existential cast. John Kerry called the conference the last best hope for the world, and Prince Charles, now King of Britain, described it as literally the last chance saloon. In his opening remarks, Boris Johnson, then the British Prime Minister, a Conservative, of course, who surfed into office on the nativist tide of Brexit, warned, "It's 1 minute to midnight on that doomsday clock, and we need to act now." In a rare and celebrated return to the global stage, Barack Obama warned that despite meaningful progress, the world was still nowhere near where we need to be. Since leaving office, Obama has presented himself primarily as a long-view meliorist, but at Glasgow, he tried to sound more like the rabble-rousing community organizer of legend. To all young people out there, as well as those of you who consider yourselves young at heart, I want you to stay angry, he advised from the stage. I want you to stay frustrated, but channel that anger, harness that frustration, keep pushing harder and harder for more and more, because that is what is required. What changed? In short, everything but the science, which continued to generate grim warnings about the speed and consequences of temperature rise, even as the fever of climate panic appeared to subside. In its place at first, we got the pandemic, which not only canceled climate conferences and interrupted the green energy rollout, but also seemed eventually to undermine the spirit of global solidarity that lay beneath the broader project. Climate protest almost disappeared, and when it returned a few years later, the numbers were much smaller, the reception much chillier. Climate activists were once venerated as moral authorities by heads of state and a broadly liberal mass media. Now they are being given jail sentences stretching multiple years for the crime of merely planning protests that might block up commuter traffic, or for throwing paint against plexiglass they knew would protect the artwork hung behind it. A victimless publicity stunt, if ever there was one. Amid the pandemic, a surge of inflation soon brought about a spike in interest rates and, with it, an end to the era in which world leaders felt like public spending was free. There were wars in Ukraine and Gaza, which exploded the fantasy that the world had passed into a more stable and peaceful state, and which, in the first case, produced the largest energy crisis since the 1970s, one that Europe managed in part by spending more on direct fossil fuel subsidies than it did on green energy investments. In the years that followed Paris, you would often hear the phrase World War II-style mobilization invoked to inspire climate action of the same scale and urgency. Instead, we have gotten a real remilitarization, with Europe responding to the war in Ukraine and the re-election of Donald Trump by promising to more than triple military spending to 5% of gross domestic product, which happens to be close to what the IEA once projected would be necessary for a global mobilization on climate. But it wasn't just the return of history that surprised climate advocates. The terrain of politics proved surprisingly bumpy, too. The Paris Agreement wasn't a projection of a single worldview beamed out from Brussels or Davos. Indeed, some of the most striking rhetoric it produced was from vulnerable nations that regarded the terms of agreement as a betrayal. But a few common threads of political presumption ran into it and out of it. That support for decarbonization would naturally grow over time, especially given an informed public. That a new era of intensifying climate extremes would amplify that trend rather than flatten it. That large-scale green investment would produce palpable benefits to the public, and that those benefits would reliably erode whatever public resistance to climate action remained, at least once the pernicious influence of the fossil fuel business could be swept out of the public square. Few advocates believed naively in the caricatured versions of those propositions, but even so, it was seductive to imagine a kind of flywheel effect unfolding, with faster action enabling still faster action through public enthusiasm for a new and transformative green industrial revolution. At least when it came to politics, the flywheel never got spinning. Globally, concern about warming is still rising, but only slowly, and while large majorities in many countries say they support faster decarbonization, other polls show that voters don't actually prioritize decarbonization and, crucially, aren't willing to pay much to bring it about. Progressives long believed that climate politics was a kind of tug of war in which tugging harder would pull many on the other side over the line into grudging support. To some degree, that is what happened after Paris, with advocates shifting the Overton window pretty dramatically and winning meaningful gains along the way. But it also looks a bit as if they pulled so hard they collapsed in disarray. In the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act was hailed as an unprecedented investment in the country's green energy future. Today, just 3 years after passage, Biden's signature legislative achievement has been stripped bare, and while the bill didn't produce a large-scale backlash, as long feared, it also failed to inspire a broad political coalition to defend it. And yet, there is good news. Global leaders may be talking less about the risks of warming and the necessity of limiting it these days, but on the ground, decarbonization is nevertheless racing ahead. It's not about climate politics anymore, says Christiana Figueres, former head of the UN's Framework Convention on Climate Change and one of the architects of Paris. It's about climate economy. It took almost 70 years from the invention of the solar cell in 1954 for the world to install its first terawatt of solar power in 2022. The second one came 2 years later. The third, perhaps later this year. In 2024, renewables provided more than 40% of the world's electricity, and twice as much money was invested in them than in fossil fuels. Even though renewables offer, generally speaking, less return on investment. 93% of new power worldwide came from clean sources, meaning that for every new unit of dirty capacity brought online in 2024, there were 24 units of the good, clean stuff. This is not enough to push global emissions downward, but in a battle between old energy and new, it represents an obliterating margin. As soon as next year, it is estimated, renewables will be the world's largest source of electricity. In certain ways, the story is one that moderates and skeptics long predicted, that decarbonization could not be reliably imposed from above on moralistic terms and would have to be powered instead by market forces, private investment, and the informed consensus of a price-conscious public. These are familiar and somewhat simplistic neoliberal bromides, and if they now look prophetic, it is also a strange kind of prophecy. Global policymakers may be leaving climate increasingly to markets, but they are doing so even as in other realms they are embracing a new language of muscular state capacity and interventionist industrial policy. Since the pandemic, the United States has wagered an awful lot of its economic future on AI. And although that requires an awful lot of new electricity, the new administration has not just kneecapped the Inflation Reduction Act, but also undertaken a genuine war on renewables, which appear to most analysts to be the fastest and cheapest method of delivering all that power. As a result, even as U.S. solar power has grown 200 times over in 20 years, the country nevertheless looks increasingly like a petrostate, especially to outsiders who have long viewed America's commitment to climate goals with skepticism and may see some petrostate-like features in our political system as well. Autocratic elements, more open corruption, dynasticism. And the other side of the great power rivalry? China has made a different bet and is fast becoming what people in Silicon Valley raised on science fiction like to call the world's first electrostate. A decade ago, those who saw themselves as energy realists would often argue that moving faster on decarbonization amounted to a self-imposed handicap that would benefit less scrupulous powers like China. But the actual pattern of recent history has been the inverse. As the United States has moved more slowly on green tech, China has stormed ahead. In fact, if you had to name the single biggest development in climate geopolitics since Paris, it would be the startling rise of China as a green energy superpower in the midst of what looked, at the outset of the period, like a global future still dominated by an indispensable United States. 74% of all global solar power and wind projects are now being constructed in China or by Chinese companies, and in the 12-month period ending this June, China installed more solar power within its borders than America has ever brought online. So far this year, China has installed twice as much solar as the rest of the world put together, and the country's command over the world's green supply chain is now famous enough to be an energy world cliché. Not just the world's first electrostate, Princeton's Jesse Jenkins wrote earlier this summer, China will be the global clean tech hegemon whose ability to confer cheap clean energy has already become one unmistakably valuable source of soft power. Between 2019 and 2024, the country's foreign investment in green manufacturing has grown more than 25-fold, and just since 2022, its green tech industry has spent more abroad than the United States did on the Marshall Plan. As the former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers put it a few years ago, there is a growing acceptance of fragmentation and, maybe even more troubling, I think there's a growing sense that ours may not be the best fragment to be associated with. Consider Pakistan. When Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, it threw the world's energy markets into crisis, sending already high prices soaring and redirecting fossil fuels headed to markets in the developing world instead to energy-starved Europe, where each shipment could fetch a still higher price. In Pakistan, as elsewhere in South Asia, the result was rolling blackouts and widespread political discontent. And then something miraculous happened. Without any coordination or planning, millions of frustrated Pakistanis began buying and importing rooftop solar panels manufactured in China, which had grown so inexpensive that in some global markets they were cheaper to buy than the wood for a yard fence. The result? Once a green energy afterthought, Pakistan is now the sixth largest solar market in the world, with recent solar additions equal to the entire country's pre-existing electric grid, all thanks to what the Carnegie Endowment's Noah Gordon and David Magalmurdy called a disorganized bottom-up boom, and the entrepreneur Azim Asar and the researcher Nathan Warren called a silent energy revolution. It was silent enough the boom hadn't even shown up in any official reports and had to be sleuthed out via satellite imagery by Bloomberg NEF's solar analyst Jenny Chase. Now batteries are flooding in too, with imports from China up eightfold to Pakistan since just 2023. And it does not appear that Pakistan is exceptional, only early. According to estimates from the think tank Ember, several dozen countries may be ready to make the same jump, though presumably with more direct support from their governments. According to a forthcoming report by the Net Zero Industrial Policy Lab at Johns Hopkins, the number is 50, or perhaps even higher, its co-director Tim Sahe told me. In many countries across sub-Saharan Africa, imports of Chinese solar panels have grown tenfold since 2023. In a few, they've grown more than 100-fold. For the first time in 2 centuries, the West is no longer the leader in future technology, but the follower. Sahe recently wrote with Kate McKenzie in the online journal Polycrisis. The historian Adam Tooze has taken to suggesting that the entire history of global modernity should be rewritten with the rapid recent development of China as the core analytic prism and narrative center. The shape of the green transition is being rewritten too. If dirt-cheap green tech can enable developing nations to declare a kind of energy independence, they can extract themselves from exploitative relationships with petrostates and protect themselves from inflation and punishing debt. Just a few years ago, skeptics of decarbonization liked to point to the 600 million people worldwide who lack access to electricity, or the billion-plus living in what's called energy poverty, to argue for the continued expansion of fossil fuels. But recently, the hard-headed investor and policymaker, Jigar Shah, who led the Department of Energy's venture capital-style loans programs office under Biden, has started to predict that clean tech will bring an end to energy poverty globally within a decade. Perhaps the retreat of the United States needn't represent a global setback, but simply a redrawing of the map for climate geopolitics. Maybe it's even for the best. Figueres calls it a more distributed world, with Trump rendering the United States irrelevant on climate, and most other countries pleasantly surprised at how little difference that really makes for them and their green energy futures. Probably there is some wisdom in that view. America was never a purely beneficent actor on climate, having spiked several previous rounds of negotiations and operating always enough out of self-interest that the poorest and most vulnerable countries were often left in distress at American indifference. If the U.S. isn't there, the political scientist Jeff Mann told me, I have a little more faith. But it's hard for me to be quite so optimistic, and not only because warming is proceeding at a terrifying pace and the task of adapting to future risks is growing by the day. A decade ago, the scale of that challenge alarmed me, but I also took the intuitive lessons of the crisis to be ones so elementary they could be mocked as naive. That we are all in this together, billions of us living on one planet. That while our vulnerabilities varied, they also revealed our shared humanity, and that the most humane response to a crisis facing us all would be one that pulled the world forward together to address the needs of those with the least. Perhaps it was always foolish to believe the world might fulfill the headline dream of Paris and keep warming close to 1.5 degrees, and perhaps the promises to do so were always empty, as the most informed always suspected. Perhaps a hands-off green transition can still deliver relatively rapid decarbonization, or at least steer us clear of catastrophic warming scenarios. But as the planet races past targets that terrified so many into action not so long ago, on its way toward 2 degrees and the jagged future on the other side, I would rather it didn't seem to be abandoning that secondary aspiration, that beyond the logic of national self-interest, we still actually owe one another something, a better, more just, more equitable future for all. In March, the UN considered a resolution to establish an International Day of Hope and an International Day of Peaceful Coexistence. On both propositions, The United States voted no. I would now like to take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Our next article, How a Group of Students in the Pacific Islands Reshaped Global Climate Law. They watched climate change ravage their home countries as rich, polluting nations did nothing. Then they had an idea. This article was written by Brooke Jarvis. The group of students who logged into Justin Rose's class on international environmental law in February 2019 were spread out across thousands of miles of ocean. Many were based at the Port Vila campus on Efate, a small but mountainous island of vivid tropical green in the middle of Vanuatu's archipelago of volcanoes, where the University of the South Pacific's School of Law is based. But USP also had campuses in Fiji, Samoa, Tuvalu, the Cook Islands, Kiribati, and other island nations, places that were experiencing some of the most pronounced impacts of the planet's fast-changing climate. It was always a tough class to teach, Rose, an Australian expert in Pacific Island law, told me in July. There are few classes in which the profound impacts of climate change feel less theoretical or the power of the students more constrained. As the class began, rising seas meant that villages across the South Pacific were already being compelled to move to higher ground, forcing people to abandon their homes and the livelihoods that once sustained them. Often the graveyards left behind slid into the sea, scattering bones into the surf. Some countries were so low-lying that they were in danger of erasure. It's a pretty grim thing to have to do year after year, to tell young Pacific Islanders that the best available science says they won't have habitable sovereign territory within their lifetimes, Rose says. Coral reefs were bleaching and dying in the warming water, taking with them the complex communities of fish and other creatures that depend on them for food and shelter, and impoverishing the many people who rely on the ocean for food. Precious fresh water was becoming unusable for farming or drinking as it mixed with rising seawater. Devastating tropical cyclones had become an annual occurrence, flooding cities and destroying homes and infrastructure. Even the USP campus on Efate was badly hit 4 years earlier by a Category 5 cyclone that displaced 45% of the residents of Tuvalu before slamming into Vanuatu and damaging 90% of the buildings in the country's capital. Because we were a small class of students from the Pacific Islands, we had that empathy for each other, Sulia Makasini, who attended from Tonga, remembers. Most times when we were discussing, there's not much words needed because we all know exactly what we all are going through. She grew up near the Fanga Uta Lagoon, which was once a key source of food, but is now polluted and overfished, and watched as sea levels rose, erasing once familiar beaches. Just a year earlier, a Category 4 tropical cyclone devastated the country, flattening the parliament building where she worked and cutting off power, internet, and water for weeks afterward. In Tonga, she said, anyone could see that climate change is the most prevalent threat and issue facing us right now. Makasini applied to law school because she wanted to know what her government's responsibilities were to her as a citizen. She also wanted to know what international law had to say about the responsibilities of other countries, especially those doing the most to cause the warming of the planet. Unlike Tonga, whose 100,000 people contribute an estimated 1/100th of 1% of global emissions. The harm was exceedingly clear. What was less clear was what could be done about it. The class began working through the basics of the international laws and treaties that govern the environment. It was disorienting to be studying laws that were supposed to protect the natural world while living through so much environmental destruction, or for that matter, to be teaching those laws. Margaretha Weewerwink Singh, a legal scholar who was then a lecturer at USP, told me that she convened the first meeting of a class on international climate law inside a classroom with blown-out windows and a floor drenched in stormwater. Tolu Mulyana, a lecturer in the geography department at USP's campus in Suva, Fiji, who was originally from Samoa, decided to go back to school so that he would know what to tell his students about their options in a future transformed by climate change. In the environmental law class, he told me, his voice catching in his throat, "What I was pouring into my assignments was my own worries about the implications of climate change on me as a person, but particularly my children." It was the grave of his young son, buried in Fiji, far from home, that he found himself worrying about the most, a dread that rose to panic any time there was a king tide or a cyclone. When the class met in 2019, it had been a little more than 3 years since the adoption of the Paris Agreement, an international treaty negotiated under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to keep warming from exceeding 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. When the Paris Agreement was concluded, the youth of the world looked up to it as an instrument of hope, Cynthia Yoniuhi, a student from the Solomon Islands, later recalled. But that hope is already beginning to fade. The agreement took more than 20 years of negotiation. Its commitments were voluntary, and studies suggested that even if they were fully met, which was looking unlikely, they would be insufficient to keep warming below the agreed-upon limit. Already the United States, the world's largest historical polluter, had, under the first Trump administration, withdrawn from the treaty entirely. Macassini remembers reading through all the laws and treaties and thinking, they're all beautifully laid out with all these beautiful commitments and obligations that the states should commit to, but it's like everything was coming to a standstill. Those treaties just exist, and there's nothing to get those states or companies that are doing a lot of environmental harm to be accountable for their actions. Rose kept thinking about the strange fact that the youth climate movement, with a famous face in Greta Thunberg, was getting more attention than ever as the political ambition to tackle climate change seemed to be faltering. He decided that it might be a useful teaching tool to ask his students, the voices of future generations in a region widely understood to be on the front lines of climate change, to approach their leaders with a suggestion about how to pressure the wider world into tackling the problem. It was unlikely to go anywhere, he thought, but the students would learn by researching and debating which levers might be most effective. There was a meeting of the Pacific Islands Forum that August that they could target for a start. It was worth a try, Rose decided. After all, everything in climate is a moonshot. In mid-March, Rose sent a note labeled Optional Extracurricular Activity to the class's message board, offering his and Weewerwink Singh's help in drafting an open letter based on a goal of the student's choosing. The replies came quickly. "Talking time is over," Mulyana responded. "It's time to do something." It wasn't immediately clear what the students should suggest. There was the idea circulating in academic circles and among civil society groups of getting the International Criminal Court to recognize ecocide, the willful destruction of nature, as a crime. Perhaps the Pacific nations could pressure the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea to classify fossil fuel emissions as a pollutant that affected the ocean, and thus something that parties to that treaty had an obligation to reduce. Or perhaps one of the Pacific Island nations could file a lawsuit in the International Court of Justice, the branch of the United Nations that adjudicates disputes among countries, against the nations emitting the bulk of the pollution harming their land, seas, and people. Solomon Yeo, a student from the Solomon Islands, knew that was tricky. The class was learning that international courts had never really clarified how climate change should be treated under international law, not even which laws would apply. How can you litigate, Yeos asked, when you're not 100% sure about the law? In 2011, two Pacific Island states, Palau and the Marshall Islands, tried to seek that clarity from the ICJ, though it's best known for settling contentious cases that countries bring before it. The court also issues advisory opinions, official pronouncements detailing how the court believes specific legal questions should be answered when requested to by the General Assembly or Security Council. The two nations wanted to ask the court whether the world countries have a legal responsibility to ensure that their greenhouse gas emissions don't harm other nations. Specifically, they wondered whether the No harm rule, which holds that states are duty-bound to keep their activities from causing environmental damage beyond their borders, applied when it came to climate change. But the effort fizzled in the face of the opposition from the United States and other countries. By the time the class was meeting in 2019, the idea of getting an advisory opinion on climate change from the ICJ was seen as just too out there, too ambitious, like something that couldn't be done, says Ralph Regenvanu, who was then Vanuatu's foreign affairs minister and is now its climate minister. Still, the students in Rose's class were intrigued. As part of their legal education, many were studying not just environmental law, but also the laws that govern human rights. The two are generally treated as separate bodies of law, but to the students, that distinction made little sense. Many of the rights enshrined in international treaties, the right not to be arbitrarily deprived of property, for example, or the right to sovereignty or to an adequate standard of living, were the very ones their communities were in danger of losing. For us, it was quite clear that climate change does impact our basic human rights, Madeline Lavimai, a student from Tonga, says. If they ask the ICJ for an opinion that took human rights treaties and the ICJ's own previous opinions into account, the results could be groundbreaking. We were just merging everything we were learning, Makassini remembered later. It seemed fairly obvious. If all these laws already existed, shouldn't they also apply to the huge problem that was climate change? The ICJ was also an appealing venue, Yeo recalls, because theoretically, at least, the path to get there was as open to small countries like theirs as it was to the world's most powerful nations. Learning about the international process, especially the UN, you come to understand that, you know, the United States has one vote, not two, not three, one vote. Same as Solomon Islands, same as Fiji, same as Vanuatu. And he knew there must be many countries beyond the Pacific that were also feeling the effects of climate change and looking for accountability. What if they could get them all on board? Earlier in his legal education, Yeo became obsessed with a previous attempt to reach the ICJ in the 1990s. Then the question was whether the use of nuclear weapons was permissible under international law. The court eventually answered that it generally wasn't, but didn't rule out self-defense in extreme cases. That, too, had been a long-shot attempt initiated by Pacific Islanders armed only with fax machines, but Yeo had noticed the language of that opinion making its way into new documents and policies, and even an international treaty. Motarila Vayu Hilda Lini, a tribal chief who served as Vanuatu's Minister of Health and championed the case, became one of his personal heroes. And finally, the politics of climate change had shifted radically since 2011. Climate-driven disasters were becoming bigger and more deadly, displacing millions around the world and transforming how the public understood the urgency of the threat. The scientific consensus on the mechanisms and dangers of climate change had advanced considerably, as had the science necessary to attribute specific harms to specific emissions. It was looking increasingly likely, as Tim Stevens, a professor at the University of Sydney Law School, wrote in 2019, that the ICJ would be called in any way when states started suing one another over failure to comply with climate treaties. And then there was the growing international frustration with the limitations of international climate negotiations, which were dominated by large emitters. Rose consulted with friends who were experts in international law, some of them the same people who previously cautioned against going to the ICJ. They were now saying, "Well, you know, this spaceship is about to crash," Rose remembers. "Time to pull all the levers we haven't pulled yet." The students wrote a letter and a brief to the leaders of the nations in the Pacific Islands Forum. "We look to an intervention by the ICJ," they wrote, "to endorse at the highest level our fundamental moral and legal rights to live with dignity without fear of climate change, denying us and our children of that freedom." It wasn't easy, especially given the end-of-semester stress, to gather everyone's signatures in person. Muliana, who was traveling to the Tonga campus for lectures, tracked down the students there, sometimes sneaking into the rooms where they were taking exams. In the end, they attached 2 pages of signatures from 27 students. "It felt a little silly," Lavamai remembers. "At the time, we didn't think the adults would take the youth or young people seriously." Makasini looked down at the page and laughed a little to herself. "These little names, I didn't think anyone's going to care who we are and what our names are." While the students were working on the letter, Rose added a video to the class's online platform. It showed a presentation Regan Vanu made to the Climate Vulnerable Forum, an association of 74 countries, home to 1.4 billion people, that work together to push for climate action. "The climate loss and damages ravaging Vanuatu will not go unchallenged," he said. "My government is now exploring all avenues to utilize the judicial system in various jurisdictions, including under international law, to shift the costs of climate protection back onto the fossil fuel companies, the financial institutions, and the governments that actively and knowingly created this existential threat to my country." The students knew that they needed to find a country to lead the process of making a request to the UN. Vanuatu had been at the forefront of advocating for climate justice ever since it helped form the Alliance of Small Island States in 1990 and began lobbying for industrialized nations to help pay for the loss and damage vulnerable countries faced in a changing climate. They asked to set up a meeting. Regan Vanu remembers the students' nervousness as well as their passion. They stressed that they had considered a number of options but were strongly in favor of approaching the ICJ. Though still skeptical, Regan Vanu didn't think it was his role to say no to these hopeful students. "I said, look, let's try, let's put it on the agenda and see if we get the support." When the Pacific Islands Forum at its August meeting noted the proposal but failed to endorse it, the students dug into advocacy. They had already formed an organization with Yo as president and Lavamai as vice president, a promise to themselves to keep pushing no matter the outcome. They called it Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change and adopted a slogan: "We are taking the world's biggest problem to the world's highest court." Vishal Prasad, a USP student who joined the organization in the first few months and later became its campaign director, saw a family home in Fiji destroyed in 2016 by Cyclone Winston, then the most destructive tropical cyclone to hit the southern Pacific. "The goal was immense," he said later, "but the plan that we developed was one that seemed plausible because we had broken down the whole journey, the whole mountain that we had to climb, into bite-sized steps that needed to be taken." Balinyar Rikimani, a Solomon Islander who originally applied to law school so she could help her family with land disputes, joined the campaign shortly after arriving at the USP Vanuatu campus in the fall of 2019. She remembers the work being a strange but exciting mix. Sometimes it meant making tuna or egg sandwiches for events. sometimes moderating panels of visiting experts. A big part of the strategy was casting an advisory opinion not as something legal and wonky, but as a basic question that affected everyone. If the ICJ ruled that all of international law had bearing, not just the narrow agreement set out in Paris, then climate change wouldn't be about some esoteric negotiations by bigwigs a world away, but about the simple right to keep living in your own home. The group reached out to prominent legal experts to add to what eventually became a long list of endorsers. They made music videos, collaborated with artists, and enlisted civil society groups, small and regional as well as large and international, as supporters. By December, Ricky, Mani, and Yeo were lobbying Pacific Island leaders at the International Climate Talks in Madrid. There they also met youth campaigners from other countries who started another organization, World Youth for Climate Justice, to push the idea to their own leaders. They knew that getting an advisory opinion would require a majority vote of the General Assembly. For that, they would need support from dozens of countries, reaching far beyond the Pacific. For a long time, Yeo says, this felt next to impossible. The COVID pandemic pushed most organizing online. It was hard to get new country delegations on board. At international climate negotiations, he watched grand public talk about international responsibility come to nothing. If I had a penny for every time I've been talked down to, ridiculed, ignored, and sidelined, Yeo says, just a few people managed to keep this thing alive. He moved to New York for 2 years, working with the Vanuatu delegation at the UN. Eventually, things began to shift. In March 2022, CARICOM, an alliance of Caribbean nations, announced that it supported Vanuatu. In June, the Organization of African, Caribbean, and Pacific States, a bloc of 79 countries, signed on. And in July, 3 years after the students' first attempt, the Pacific Islands Forum announced its support. By then, some of the students involved in the campaign had finished law school and gotten jobs in the very governments they were trying to persuade to go to the ICJ. Vanuatu convened a core group of 18 countries with representatives from regions around the world to shepherd the resolution through the General Assembly and carefully frame the specific legal questions. Finally, in March 2023, 4 years after Rose proposed his extracurricular assignment, the General Assembly took its vote. By then, there were 134 co-sponsors, and the resolution passed, not with the split vote that Yeo had expected, but by consensus. I'm sorry, that's all the time we have. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.